This is Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing the oral history interview with Janice Josephine Carney. Today's date is the 7th of June, 2005. I'm on the campus of Texas Tech, and Janice is on the telephone in Florida. And Janice, thanks for continuing this afternoon. I really appreciate your time, as you know. And let's start today, if you don't mind, with some kind of routine issues, really, about what daily work was for you as the battalion mail clerk. You described a few of the duties that you had, but before you went up to the border and beyond of Laos, what was a day like for you once you had that new assignment?
At first it was really easy. It was a really good, relatively good duty. Mm-hmm. I got assigned a driver every day. At that point, they were kind of, a lot of times it was the same driver. And
was this a Vietnamese driver or
American?
Oh,
no, this is from our unit, from our, mm-hmm. because normally the Vietnamese clerk would have drove himself and had a shotgun. But I just took the position of the shotgun because I didn't drive.
Right.
But the rules were at all times you needed a driver and a shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
So it really wasn't that, you know, that if they had assigned me the vehicle from the motor pool every day, and for a while I had a Jeep that I had access to anytime I wanted, which was kind of neat, in Vietnam.
Yeah, that would have been almost a status symbol in some ways.
Oh, it was. I was constantly having people ask me if I could do them a little favor.
Sure.
Run down to Fubai and pick something up for them.
Did you actually do that sometimes, or did it depend?
I did it a number of times, and only one time I let somebody borrow my Jeep.
Mm-hmm.
And I never did that again. I almost got court-martialed.
What happened?
He was down in the village. He was getting some OV, which is obestatol, which is a drug a lot of us use. It was a product made in France for losing weight.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a little bar, but it was liquid speed. I mean, one little bottle of this stuff, and you were up for a couple of days.
Wow, okay.
And it was commonly used over there. OB was what they called it.
OB?
Yeah, it stood for obestatol.
Okay.
And I let them take the Jeep, because I was the only one that had a key, because we used to keep that locked up at the headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
And all I got was that there was somebody was shot. First, the rumor was that I was shot, because I was the only one that was supposed to act in theory.
Right, in theory.
I had the Jeep.
Right. Uh-huh.
And it turned out that the person that got shot lost their hand.
Really?
Yeah, and I don't think nobody really knows what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But they wrote it up that it was an accident, that a round went off from the heat of the engine.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they finally ended up writing it.
Mm-hmm.
And they wrote it off as non-combative related in an accident.
Mm-hmm.
And shipped him back to the States.
And I presume this was done because he was on some illicit mission that
wasn't
authorized.
Yeah, he was off the base.
Right.
He was in civilian clothes. Mm-hmm. A couple of very highly no-nos.
Was this a friendly doctor, would you say, who kind of managed the situation, or do you not know that part of it?
Well, medically, it was a typical medical evacuation, as if, anything had happened.
Yeah.
But it was when it got to the command, because when he found out it was my Jeep, but I wasn't there, and it wasn't in an official capacity,
mm-hmm.
It's very similar. A lot of things in Vietnam, they try to limit our casualty rates. Just really exaggerated the enemy's casualty rates.
And this fits in that category?
Right. Anything that they could list, and I'm 100% sure they're doing the same thing in Iraq,
mm-hmm.
that any anything they can list as non-combative related, you know, or an accident, mm-hmm. then it wasn't in on the casualty reports.
Right. What did you hear about what had actually happened?
I heard he got shot in the hand from a Vietnamese type person. Something went wrong. He was doing a drug deal.
Okay. So it wasn't a sniper by the side of the road. It was
no,
somebody
it was
who was involved.
Somebody.
In
the but a lot of the people that we dealt with the drugs,
mm-hmm.
any of the black market stuff.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them, you know, a lot of them were really Viet Cong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anybody with half a brain, you didn't have no idea where that money was going. I mean, I think it's the same on a whole when you're dealing with any kind of drug dealer.
Right.
I never got to talk to him, so I don't know exactly what went wrong.
Okay.
I mean, he may have tried to rip off the Vietnamese.
Did any kind of sales continue after this incident? Do you know?
Oh, yeah, it was always a lot of. I mean, I was over there in 71,
mm-hmm.
and the heroin use and marijuana use and the opiate use was just really high.
Was opiate the most popular thing, do you think?
Yeah, for a lot of the combat situations. There was a point later on when I was up in Vietnam, I mean, on Vandegrift, when I was really going back and forth and just start sleeping, I couldn't have functioned without it. I mean, there was a point where I think I was up for 3 days.
Mm-hmm. And can you describe for somebody who doesn't know the situation up there why you were in such a way that you were not getting sleep at all? I mean, was it the amount of work? Was it the stress of the situation you were in, or all of that?
It was a combination of all of it. I'll get up to that. The original question, where in Fubai, I had a very short distance I was driving from San Diego.
Yes.
A very short mail run. Uh-huh. And twice a week I had to go down to Da Nang, which was where we would get sniped fire occasionally. But it was a lot, it wasn't as dangerous, and it was much more. But when we went up to Camp Eagle, the fire base.
Vandegrift.
Vandegrift, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Off, and I was going across Highway 9 to an area called the Rock Pile and down to Way and down to Run. I was going to areas that I was driving to every morning when it was still hand spraying, Agent Orange.
Did you say hand spraying?
Yeah, they used to hand spray along the side of the road outside of... the areas along the rock pile and coming up from the fire base.
Yeah.
It was the last year that they did it.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what they claimed.
Mm-hmm.
And into the rock piles and landmines. And every day was a different driver. But this time I was adamant. I did not want to know any of the drivers. Just didn't want to know them. Even if they told me their first name, I would just ignore them. I just did not want to know anybody. I mean, I just crossed that line.
Where you didn't want to, like, invest in knowing them because something might happen?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Between, you know, seeing drivers shot and, you know, seeing a few, you know, the worst ambush I went through was the truck in front of us, both guys got killed. And it was just a matter of seconds that it would have been my truck that hit the landmine.
So the incident that you're referring to, the truck that was in front of you did hit a roadside landmine?
Yeah.
In the road?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the whole time period when I was doing this, near the end, I would get up in the morning, and I would be the first vehicle off the firebase. What they would do is every morning they have landmine sweepers
mm-hmm.
go to this area of Highway 9.
Okay.
That connects down to Highway 1.
Yes.
And when you got a clear, that it was clear for mines,
mm-hmm.
I would get a go sign. And I would go, and I would usually have a gun truck behind me with a couple of M60s on it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I cleared that section of Highway 9, they would radio back an all clear. It didn't open it up for all traffic.
So, I mean, is it fair to say that you were the guinea pig for the first run of the day kind of thing?
Yeah.
And this was this standard for mail carriers?
No, this was just, I demanded it.
Why?
Because I wanted to get out as early as possible in daylight. Because I had to get all the way down to Camp Eagle, Fubai, sometimes Da Nang. I had to pick up all kinds of orders and documentation. I was in what was known as the Forward Battalion Command Headquarters. So I had to connect with battalion headquarters for orders and any written directives with division headquarters and then pick up the mail. I wasn't just a battalion mail clerk, I was a courier too.
And so in the course of one day, you might be all the way from Camp Eagle down to Da Nang?
Yeah.
And out, how far in country, how far inland?
I honestly don't remember the miles.
Sure, that's okay.
The clicks, but it was it could be done expediently and just doing what I had to do, you know, and not hang around, and I could get back before dark.
But you had to get up early to do it.
Right, because the thing is, under no circumstances that I want to be out in the road, you know, once the sun sets. And then the second part of it is that after doing all that, you know, once that driver got me back, he was done for the day. But I actually had a whole other job I had to do. When I got back, I had to get all the line company mail clerks to come and pick up their mail, drop off the outgoing mail for the next day. And we had several companies. I had to, any kind of paperwork involving, forwarding mail and people that would, I actually had a rubber stamp that said deceased on it. That when I got mail for soldiers that were deceased, so I would have to stamp a deceased and send it back.
How did you find, what list were you working from? How did you get an official or updated list of who could no longer receive their mail because they've been killed?
I would have to get a daily report
from
every company mail clerk. And that was the other side of it, where with the companies had casualties, I had to go with the battalion mail clerk, go with the company mail clerk, and ensure that all the personal belongings were packaged.
You personally had to?
Yeah. It should have been a lieutenant, but I got caught up doing it. We didn't have an executive officer.
You mentioned that there was no XO for these kinds of duties.
Yeah, that's who should have been doing it. You know, that part of it. So I at a point in this, was literally, from the morning going out and back, and then most of the, when I got back, I still had all these other duties. And then we'd have everything set to go in the morning. And then if you add to it that we were constantly getting rocket attacks and ground attacks at night.
This was in Camp Eagle still?
Well, this is all on Rindigris.
Okay.
This is what I'm saying. It was a huge difference. On Camp Eagle, we would occasionally get, isolated rocket attacks. And I don't think we had any ground attacks while I was on Eagle.
What kind of a base was Vandergriff? Was it a fire support base?
Yeah, it was what they call a fire support base. It really, there was just a whole chain of them along the Laotian border. And this was going to the end of February, March, and April. Or 71 when he had the Operation Lomsoon 719. Which is the evasion into Laos?
Yes.
This is what the operation.
Some of those operations were moving out from Vandergriff.
Right. What it was was the United States Army had up there was support units.
Yes.
All the combat units were Arvins, which was the whole concept of this operation.
Yes.
It's all along the Laotian border. There were these support fire bases.
Mm-hmm.
The best known one was Mary Ann, which was the one that got overran.
Yes.
But it was just a whole chain, and the 39th Transportation Battalion was, its assignment was to supply, we were the transportation link to all these bases.
Vandergrift was?
Well,
your unit?
Our battalion.
Okay.
That was their function, you know, as a transportation battalion, and this is why we were right along the Laotian border. Because we were, any supplies that were coming in by truck, you know, we were bringing in.
Mm-hmm. So, was Highway 9 the principal route up there, or had other roads been cut?
That was the only road.
Mm-hmm.
You had Highway 1, which literally ran from Saigon up to Hanoi, which is an ancient old road that just went straight up.
Yes.
To the city of Wei.
Yes.
And once you got up to Wei, there was this other highway called Highway 9
mm-hmm.
that cuts to, I guess it would be west inland.
Mm-hmm.
And that just eventually would go right into Laotian, into Laos.
And it's up near Quezon?
Yeah.
And so on.
Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If you... Quezon and Camp Carroll. Have you ever heard of Camp Carroll?
Carroll, C-A-R-R-O-L-L?
Yeah.
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah. When the Marines were at Quezon in 68,
yeah.
Camp Carroll was the base just southeast of Quezon.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Vandergrift was Camp Carroll.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they reopened it and renamed it.
The same location.
Yeah.
Okay, wow.
He had said, what they did is, when he started his operation in 719, there's actually a fairly decent book out about the operation
mm-hmm.
called Long Term 719. Ken something knows. Ken
Nolan? Nolan?
Yeah.
N-O-L-A-N.
Yeah,
Keith Nolan, I think, uh-huh.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Yeah. He wrote that, and there's some stuff about me in that book. You'd have to go by the name I served on at John Joseph County.
Mm-hmm. You're actually mentioned in the text?
We did some interviews.
Okay.
And
do you know what happened to those interviews, Janice? Do you know where they are? Or he still has them?
I don't know if he recorded them or not. They're all
mm-hmm.
done over the phone.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But if you have any, you know, contact with him, or
mm-hmm.
you know, I don't even know if the book is still in print on anymore. I looked for it.
I'm pretty sure we have some copies here.
Yeah, it was at Presidio Press.
Mm-hmm. How did he find you to interview you? I mean, it's really interesting that he spoke with you.
I think it was through. He just got my number from the series of interviews. He'd done a lot of research.
Mm-hmm.
And my name had just come up as
somebody who was around.
Yeah, somebody who was a little over the edge. I think it was a line in the book. He was talking about me, you know, on the verge of a breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
And he described me as being too sensitive to deal with it.
Is that essentially accurate?
Yeah, it's accurate, but at the time, when the book came out, I was extremely upset.
Did you call him?
Oh, yeah. I just
and let him know?
Yeah, but he just kind of said that's how he saw it. And, you know, years later, I had a lot of therapy in England.
Mm-hmm.
I could now agree with him, but I kind of took that as an insult to my manhood, back when I had a manhood.
And those days are gone now.
Those days are gone.
Right.
But today, it's a whole different life. You have to be a sensitive man, too. But.
That's true. That whole thing has shifted, but you've done your own transitioning. Right? So.
But it's... I forgot what it was going with. But he... Yeah, I really was amazed the first time he called me.
I'm sure you were.
And he said he got my name from somebody. He mentioned somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And, I ended up sending him a bunch of pictures. And we talked at about a dozen times over the course of the year.
Wow.
And, I think he was out of Montana. But anyway, but it was really interesting at the time because I don't kind of think so I was in. Yeah, I was just starting in a regiment program. You know, having a lot of issues.
Roughly when would this have been?
In
the 80s sometime?
Yeah, it was really the middle 80s.
Okay. Did talking to him kind of help you at all? Did it crystallize what you'd been through and make you focus on it, or?
It was kind of like therapy at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was following it through, and the different people that he had talked to,
mm-hmm.
and he had actually talked to Kudo Ellis, who I think was retired at that time,
mm-hmm.
and it kind of cracked me up. I was trying to get him to give me the colonel's address so I can go harass him. Where's he these days? I like that continual. Anyway, but it was. It helped me at the time, struggling with what it was, if it was all worthwhile or what I'd done was worth it.
Mm-hmm.
He especially when the book The Guild came out, it kind of, I'm at a loss for the extra words to describe it, but it made me feel that I was part of something, and it was an attempt to finally do something.
Hmm.
And that people did, people did respect me. The fact that other people, whatever levels they were in the unit,
mm-hmm.
Did have enough respect to say, well, you should call this person.
Yeah, on some level. Actually, on a number of levels, I can see it might have been validating.
I always, I just always felt slight of it in a lot of ways. With when you get into that macho stuff with awards and stuff,
mm-hmm.
that the level of what I did. I just felt I never really got any recognition for it.
Well, and this was, from everything you said, a very high risk position that I think people, perhaps when they hear the word mail clerk, don't have any clue about what the reality for you in that position was. Because as you mentioned, you were both a mail clerk and a courier, so this was time sensitive. Stuff that had to move in a pretty risky environment, and you mentioned the landmines. Let me ask you a little bit more about that. And Janice, if you don't want to discuss this, that's fine. There were two men who were killed in the truck in front of you. Can you tell me anything more about that incident? Was it early in the morning?
Yeah, it was early in the morning.
Uh-huh.
We were actually going to the section called the Rock Pot.
Mm-hmm.
And the truck, I don't know how it got on the road. It was unauthorized. It was coming from the opposite direction from Way.
Okay.
And there should have been nobody cleared until I had gotten down to the section on the other side of the rock pile where the minesweepers ended, a checkpoint.
Mm-hmm.
There shouldn't have been nobody on that road but me until I cleared that checkpoint.
Yet you saw this truck coming toward you.
Right.
Oncoming.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And what kind of a truck was it?
It was a deuce and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And I was my usual kind of laid-back self. So it just kind of sitting there stoned. And
you were stoned?
Yeah, I think so.
Uh-huh.
And I had my M16 and I had my camera. Mm-hmm. And I got, it's one of the pictures I have somewhere. I took a picture, because I saw it, as we're going around the corner, we heard like an explosion.
Yeah.
And just as we came around the curve, the truck was in front of us, all in flames. Mm-hmm. And I took one picture where you could see the star of my truck, and the truck in flames with both the doors blown out. And I still have that picture somewhere, besides in my mind.
Yeah, I'm sure that it's there anytime you go to look for it.
And the driver and the shotgun were both just blown over side of the road with the arms and legs blown off. Mm-hmm. The impact must have been right under the hood when it went off, literally. And we pulled over, and the driver, much more efficient than I was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he had the sense to get out of the truck and get over by the side of the road, in case of sniper fire.
Sure.
Or, 'cause we didn't know, we didn't actually know if it was an RPG. It could have been a rocket, mm-hmm. or if it was a landmine that. It could have been, I forgot what you call them, the ones that they set off with a switch.
Yeah, with a remote.
The Claymore, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. We didn't even know if that was it, because we...
Yeah, you had no way of knowing.
Yeah, there very easily could have been a small continuous, and we were up in a heavy area with NVA.
Yes.
And he got over, real quick, out of a track and over by the side of the road, they got his head down. But I was just sitting in the truck crying. I'm not sure how long. I just completely lost it.
Mm-hmm.
And all I remember is all of a sudden hearing helicopters with a medevac coming in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then by that time, he had dropped off some combat units. This is the Arvins. And they were just, people screaming everywhere. And somebody just, told me to get the truck going, get going. And the driver came back. And we ended up going down and finishing what we were supposed to do.
You did finish.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But that,
so you continued on.
Yeah. But it was after that that I just... I just never was the same after that.
About when did this happen in your tour? Any idea?
It would have been, I think,
in the spring of 71?
March.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was after, I turned 21 in Vietnam. And that was, we were still in Camp Eagle.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened in March, when we were, not sure exactly. But that's, I think the reference that Ken Nolan uses in a book, he just called me flaky.
He called you that in the book?
Yeah.
That's a bit unkind.
Yeah, but probably true. But he, flaky and how it's just like a couple of paragraphs, but he
mm-hmm.
describes how I was losing it.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody else had told him about that incident. I don't know if he had talked to the guy that actually drove the truck or not. I didn't remember who was actually driving it.
Right.
But he just, after that, I started doing more drugs, and I was crying all the time. I was still functioning and doing the job. And that's all anybody cared about. But I think under any other circumstances, I should have been pulled off it. She's not all there.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, the company mail clerks that you worked with, just to change gears a little bit, did those guys come to... Did you come to sort of have any kind of good relationships with those guys you would, these are people you would see presumably every day or so.
Well, I never really got close to any of them because I would only see them, you know, for short periods,
mm-hmm.
you know, getting the meals. And even the company meal clerks were constantly being replaced.
Really?
The company meal clerks weren't required to take the postal test.
They were not, right?
No, because they weren't qualified to pick up mail for the Army Post Office.
Only you could do that.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And you know,
they
would
bounce
clerks around, and if they needed more truck drivers, it was pretty much the people that would give any of these clerk jobs were people who, for some reason, couldn't drive trucks,
mm-hmm.
be it physical or...
But command could swap them in and out of the company clerk, mail clerk position with no, there were no restrictions on that.
No.
Okay, so you wouldn't in fact then really always be seeing the same guys. You might be somebody for a week and then somebody else.
Yeah, but yeah, mm-hmm. it would change and even with the rotations, with people leaving.
Yeah.
Where everybody was on a different, I'm out of here schedule.
Yeah, how disruptive was that? I mean, was that something that you think that probably shouldn't have been done? Or?
Yeah, that is without doubt the dumbest and biggest at all kinds of levels.
Mm-hmm.
There just never was any real unit coercion.
No cohesion.
Cohesion, yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that what I said?
I think you said coercion. There probably was some of that. But but yeah, I get what you mean, that people couldn't hang together because they were everybody was moving at a different speed in a way.
They were. I mean, people that newbies or mm-hmm. people that were shot. It was in the way, especially I think it was the real hardest for the combat infantry men.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're sitting with a friend and he gets shot in the head, and you all you see is a dust up come in, and then pull out a body bag, you know, take your friend, put him in the body bag, and just fly off. Then another plane, another helicopter come in with a new guy, and you were supposed to just say, hi, my name's Ted, and just go on like nothing happened. But it's beyond anything. I mean,
Do you think sometimes, Janice, about how things were different in other wars, especially, of course, World War II, where units went over, there was no kind of end date
service. That's part of what I was saying previously,
uh-huh, uh-huh.
With the concept of World War II. They were gonna go to France, they were going to go to any country in the way to get to Germany. But yet in Vietnam, we were not going to cross this line. We weren't going to go into that country. And the whole thing of World War II, all these units that were trained together and all these divisions that stayed together, and you were going to stay together. The goal was to defeat Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And you were going to go home when you defeated Hitler.
Right.
Or Mussolini, or if you were in... the islands with Japan.
Mm-hmm.
There was a set. There was, a conclusion.
A goal.
A goal. Yeah, mm-hmm. And you were going to stay together, win or lose.
And from what you're describing, the dynamic in Vietnam just completely different in terms of relationships among the guys that were there.
In Vietnam, it got worse and worse as it went on. From I think 1959, I think, was the first soldier killed.
Yes.
The head writer.
Right.
And so you're going from, literally from 59 to 75, and maybe when the last was killed. I think, you know, what year General John Vaughn was killed?
General John...
John Vaughn?
Oh, 72, early 72,
was it
maybe?
So it's like it must still be beyond that, with the fall of Saigon. I don't know.
I can't remember immediately right now.
Yeah.
Out of interest, he
was kind of a crazy guy, but he's one of my heroes.
How did you come to know about him?
I know some people that had served under him told me quite a lot about him.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I read The Upright Shining Light,
mm-hmm.
which I think is probably the best book ever written about Vietnam.
Really?
A big Bright Shining Light. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Neil Sheehan.
Uh-huh. He had a lot of flaws. I mean, he had a weakness for young girls.
Yes, he did.
And he had a little bit of a drinking problem.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as being, you know, a military leader with ideas and, you know, conceptions of what Vietnam was about. He fell in love with the culture. He fell in love with the people. And he really wanted, you know, a democracy there. And he wanted the Vietnamese, you know, army to win it. And I didn't meet too many officers like that.
Mm. Did you know anything about him when you were in country?
When I was in country, I knew a little bit about him. I had a sergeant that was, he's six, I think it was his third tour in Vietnam.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And he was a really crazy guy.
Uh-huh.
He was really having a hard time this time. Because I'm not too sure what years his first two tours were.
Mm-hmm.
But when he was over there in 1970, it was different.
Different.
So I got to know him fairly well.
Yeah.
And he was constantly saying it was none of his drugs, none of his rebellion when he was over in his other two tours.
Yeah, earlier on.
Yeah, so much had changed. I was a classic example. He could not believe some of the stuff I would do.
Such as?
I mean, I absolutely would totally refuse to salute our battalion commander.
Right.
And he just could not believe I had the, I'll use a good word, gumption to do that.
He had so many choices there.
Yeah, but I was, yeah.
Right.
I had the ovaries. No. But even he changed. I don't know. I'm pretty sure that he after that tour, his mind was made up to get out of the service. He had a lot of years invested.
And you think that was because of this kind of deteriorating?
Yeah. To him, the whole army had deteriorated.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there was always special officers, there was all this open rebellion.
You told us some about the race issues.
Yeah, the race issues going on.
Right.
Everything was just totally out of control.
Along that line, did you hear of or know about any fragging incidents or was that kind of stuff even talked about?
Doug, do you mind cutting off in 1 second, please?
Sure. Janice, I was asking whether you had any inkling about fragging incidents or talk of doing that. I mean, you're talking about, like, loose discipline and all of that and how things were deteriorating. And, of course, there have been reports about this, and I just wondered if anything like that ever passed by you.
I did nothing.
No, I know you probably did.
I did absolutely nothing. I heard rumors.
Mm-hmm.
From the first week, I hate laughing, but looking back on it,
mm-hmm.
that first week when I arrived in Vietnam,
yeah,
when I was with the 666 Transportation Company,
mm-hmm.
that lovely first sergeant that I talked about,
yes,
it was
mm-hmm.
such a loving, caring man.
Yes, he seemed to be, yes.
He was, I think it was the second or third night. He had this big outside area where we had the St. Joe Club, a listening club where you can get beer and wine.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And they showed outside movies on the plate, you know, like a wooden screen.
Mm-hmm.
And it had all these like wooden stools that went downhill, kind of stuff. Was sitting there watching some movie. I don't know what. And all of a sudden we hear this loud explosion up the top in one of the hoochers.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody gets up and they're all cheering. And you know, so what the hell's going on? And the guy sitting next to me goes, "Oh, they just blew up the top hooch again. Hope they got him this time."
Really?
And literally, somebody had thrown a flag.
Wow.
And I guess he had been around enough to know that one place he never slept was in his hooch. Who knows where he slept? But he ended up actually up when he was up when his unit was up on one of the fire bases.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody fragged him and he lost both his legs.
And you did you hear about that when you were still in country then?
Yeah, because I had to know because you know I seen the list of names of the medical Iraqis from our unit.
Mm-hmm.
Went from the companies. Had their list of mail that was being forwarded.
Yes.
You know, once people were Medirect, so I would have a list of names.
To forward to whatever hospital in country or beyond?
Yeah, yeah. Because
mm-hmm.
They had their records, but as the retirement clerk, I had to have a copy of all their records.
Got it.
So it was kind of like a backup system.
Right.
And then I heard, you know, when I saw that, when I asked about what happened to him, it was kind of, you know, it was 50-50. Did Charlie get him? What was it, one of us?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So he was pretty much universally not liked.
Yeah, pretty much the way he treated me was the way he treated everybody.
It sounds like when everybody was laughing when the explosion went off, all already knowing what, you know, what that meant. That's really diagnostic of what
and that was
what's going on.
Once again, this was, you know, 1970. And we had openly discussed. In fact, I had a tape that I left it at the War Memorial quite a number of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We used to, when I was on Camp Eagle, I used to hang out in the communication bunker.
Right.
And we had one of those old reel-to-reels
mm-hmm.
that was constantly playing music.
Yeah.
And sometimes you could dub over it, and there were taped conversations going on.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in there one night talking about different ways of getting rid of the ace. We all were pretty stoned anyway.
Right.
And they were talking about wiring the claymore to his phone.
Oh, shit.
And when he picked up the phone, but I said, you know, my office is right next to him. Don't do that.
Yeah. No, don't do that.
Good. God. Make sure I'm not in there.
Wow.
And I mean, it was that, you know, that blatant. And he's the kid about on the night convoys.
Mm-hmm.
If he was in, sometimes he would ride in the command vehicle.
Right.
And these all have stories about if they thought he was in the command vehicle, he'd be shooting at the command vehicle and anything else.
So you weren't the only one who thought that Ace was kind of a.
He was not well liked, I think, by the whole of the battalion commander.
Well, let me ask you about other people who, other Americans who might not have been very well liked. Did you see any kind of harassment of gay men or men who appeared to be gay or were thought to be gay or yourself? I mean, was there that kind of stuff going on too?
It was going on, and it's hard to explain. When I was on Camp Eagle, I was right next to a dust-off unit.
Okay.
And it wasn't as bad because half the male nurses are medics.
Mm-hmm.
We're pretty gay. There were a couple of men that were really flamboyant.
Flamboyant, like really apparent, obvious.
Yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh.
There was this one black guy I used to get a kick of. I think I don't know how he managed to do it, but he had perfect nails, and he painted them.
Really?
Yeah. And he.
Wow.
But he was going. He was going out of the dust up shop.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, you could hate anybody for any reason.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody in combat is gonna, you know, screw around with a medic that's going out on dust and that's all.
No, and they love those guys. I mean, they love them beyond love, really. They
and that was what I had been trained for. And,
yeah.
And so I kind of, on that side, you didn't, but in the environment, in a transportation unit, I mean, it was just like in basic training. You'd always hear comments, you know, fucking fag, this or that, and but always, you know, always trying to be as macho as you can.
That's what you were trying to do?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Janice, was that like a way of coping with being in the situation and trying to not have everybody looking at you, or was it something that, you know, you were also just trying to do for yourself? Can you talk about any of that?
Well, I can only talk, you know, on this subject about, you know, my experience.
Yes, absolutely.
I don't know what it would have been like if I actually was out in an infantry unit.
Mm-hmm.
And, that intimate. Because if I was that close with a bunch of guys, I think they just would have picked up on things about me.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have been very nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And there were guys in that position.
But, yes, you know, yes, there were.
And even, even the period of time, like when I was with the all those truck drivers, I was just petrified that somebody would pick up or something about my characteristics or something.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, something bad might have happened to me. But when I got transferred over to the headquarters company, in that environment, you know, especially with dealing with warrant officers and other specialists in these fields.
Mm-hmm.
I think at least two of the people that I was dealing with every day, I was pretty sure they were gay. But the one guy we used to joke about, I don't know how this guy would do it. I mean, this guy was just so gay. He always, every day, would have a perfectly pressed with all the wrinkle in it, pair of dress screens.
I mean,
the screens, the camouflage screens.
That's just unbelievable. I mean,
this guy had an iron and he had starch.
I can't imagine how that could even be managed. How that could even be possible.
This is all, you know, all but, Eagle. He couldn't have done it on the firebase.
Right.
And he hair perfectly combed, a perfectly thin little trim blonde mustache.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's stereotyping. But, you know, I believe in Ray Dada.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you saw, and this is what actually, you know, was what you experienced, what
yeah,
you saw.
Yeah. And he took a lot of harassment, but it was on it was kind of more on a friendlier level, because it was on a situation where it was like working, it was just working in an office, you know, with the other officers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly even what his title was. He's a warrant officer.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was my friend, Jay. These are probably the two of the people that I shared my hooch with. There were like four people in a hooch.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, maybe we could have... I never thought of this before. They kind of had us all together.
it makes you wonder, doesn't it?
It's the first time this has ever hit me.
That's interesting. So, and Jay, was he a warrant officer, too?
He was a Spec 4 like me.
Okay.
But he was another one, Macklin.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And you said cut because gelatin is quieter in the mill.
Really?
Now, that's an issue. We used to dine together. I had a couple of little hot plates and stuff. We would take turns cooking.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people thought we were the odd couple before the odd couple existed. But either one, I mean, it was like, I don't think none of us ever asked the other one or ever even, you know, approached it if you were gay or I was gay.
Right.
It just was too scary, or the thought of crossing that line. It was a lot of psychological shit, I think.
And fear?
Yeah, and fear.
And all that goes with that.
But Jay was really the one that was close to it. He was the one I learned a lot about Colonel Ace, because he was the Colonel's assistant. And he was the one who used to tell me, because he would come in at all these weird hours in the night to wake him up, that the Colonel was having these meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted him to make all these chats and stuff. That's how I knew a lot about what was going on.
Okay.
Yeah, but all these figures and everything, and he just couldn't stand it. He would make the charts and then, you know, kind of stand there.
Where was he from?
I was from Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And I, Tullius and Jelly. I wish I had known how to spell his name. It was Greek.
How do you say it?
In Jelly. In Jelly. Mm-hmm. Jelly was how he used to pronounce it.
Mm-hmm.
Julius. He used to go by Jay.
Yeah, and your kind of persona that you were putting out there was trying to be tough, and well, maybe not tough, but kind of macho.
Yeah, a typical guy when I was in that environment with the truck drivers.
Yeah,
but in that, you know, that small environment. Especially when I was dealing, any direct contact I had with the colonel,
yeah,
that was always putting on this, you know, real hard persona that, you know,
mm-hmm.
you think you scare me?
Right. But with the guys in the hooch that you were more comfortable with, could you let that down a little?
Oh yeah, I mean, totally. It was a whole, a whole different person, yeah. Really. At times, I mean, I was always, I had these two hot plates, and I would get what stuff I could get from the PX, or I would always get food packages from home.
Mm-hmm.
I would always ask them to just send me. You know, cans of spaghetti sauce or, spaghetti.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always cooking these spaghetti dinners. Because all you have to do is boil water and just, you know, with a pre-cooked sauce, just warm it up.
Sure.
And, and we'd sit around, you know, and we could get wine. We would just sit around, drink wine. We had two real glasses and chat. I mean, and talk about things besides the wine.
Right.
And we were somewhere else.
Right.
And it was,
it was
different, really.
Yeah. You could be more who you kind of were internally.
Yes.
You could let more of that out.
Yeah. It was just, at the time, it was just something feminine, but cooking a meal for a man and having a glass of wine.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kind of, going back to this time too, I honestly didn't even know what I was with all the gender issues.
Right.
I mean, this is on a personal level.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly didn't know. I mean, I was sexually attracted to women, but I just was so more inclined that I was a woman, and I was trying, and I thought the only answer was that I was gay and I better deal with it.
And that seemed to be like the only available option?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure. You had no. How would you have information about anything else?
Yes.
Back in the old days.
Yeah. It really wasn't really into the late 70s and 80s when a lot of, with the internet, a lot of stuff about gender issues came out, and there was a lot more information. But that, I remember we got into this habit, which is when we were on Camp Eagle.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first rocket attacks we had when I was there. Whenever we get, you know, sirens went off, you'd have to go out and go in these bunkers.
Yeah.
And the first time I went in, I just came running right out, and everybody was looking at me, and I said, he's a rat now. And it was a big, huge rat. And well, I could look at me like I was totally out of, you know, like trees. I mean, what the heck? What's up with that? I don't think he used that expression back then, but he had
someone. Right.
I ended up with whatever Jay kind of caught on with me.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever the sirens went off, if anybody was grabbing it, you know, the helmets and the jackets and running for the bunkers,
mm-hmm.
we would get up and go in and pour a glass of wine and just sit in the hooch.
Did you?
Yeah. And we would say, hey, you know, we'll have a toast. Hey, if it's a direct hit, goodbye.
that's really going to be hard for people to kind of picture. I mean, was that defiance? Was that kind of fatalism? Was that the hell with this? All of that stuff?
Combined with all that. I mean, I was not going to go crawling in a hole with rats. I just was not. And the odds of a direct hit on the bunker killing everybody, or the odds of a direct hit in the hooch killing us, are probably about the same.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you about this, the wine that you got. How easy was it to get?
Oh, very easy. It was harder when we went up north, but on Camp Eagle, it was a big PX in Fubai.
Could you get just as much as you wanted?
Yeah.
No limits?
Well, not really. It was supposed to be, but they really... I'm trying to think back. They had some kind of control on hard liquor.
But beer and wine...
Yeah, beer and wine was just pretty...
Where was the wine from? Any idea? Was it American?
Predominantly, you know, the basic California wine.
Oh, okay.
They do a little bit more, but it was just basically your basic, you know, cheap wine and domestic beer.
Mm-hmm. So red or white?
Oh, it depends. Red with Italian.
Okay. So there were some rules that were... that were in place.
Yeah, you never had white wine with a sign.
Okay, good enough.
I try to tell that to people. I still do.
good enough. I'm with you.
Yeah.
You mentioned when we talked yesterday, Janice, that I should ask you about the holidays and especially about Thanksgiving. Do you remember what you were thinking of?
Well, Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving dinner.
I remember because I got into. I crashed a party.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to figure out what was going on at the communist big hooch. Thanksgiving. It was the night before Thanksgiving. Actually, there was some kind of big party going on.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of stuff was brought in. And. He had air conditioning, too.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And we were just going to have, you know, the typical canned turkey and some instant potatoes on paper plates.
Sure.
The usual big... And I don't know what possessed me. For some reason, I went up and and knocked on his door. And the sergeant major answered, and I could see they were all sitting there with drinking and fancy glasses, and I just saw a big table set up. You know, with China, and I just kind of got pissed off, and I just crashed my way in, you know, diagonal with the sergeant major.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of started screaming, it just ain't right, and, you know, everybody else is eating at a paper plate and just having this, and you guys, you know, have so-called leaders, you know, having cocktails on China, and I don't really remember what I said, but I really got... And they ended up dragging me out.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to a big discussion with the sergeant major over it. And but I suspect you would him that he shouldn't have even been in there. If you know all these officers that you're supposed to be. I don't know if you know the concept of a sergeant major.
Go ahead and explain for other people
that
who might not.
He is the highest ranking enlisted man, NCO, in a unit. That's the highest rank you could reach.
Mm-hmm.
And he's one sergeant major of the Army.
Yes.
One, which is the absolute highest rank mm-hmm. you could reach as a non-commissioned officer. And at that level, you are representing your enlisted men and your NCOs. And you, for him, instead of being out with us somewhere, eating at the mess hall on paper plates,
mm-hmm.
for him to have been in an air-conditioned hooch with all these officers eating out of China, I just took it as some kind of betrayal of his position.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I articulated it that well at the time. But
you felt he personally should not have been there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was more, and that's, it was more personal between the two of us.
Mm. What penalty did you have to pay for having spoken your mind? Anything?
No, he didn't do nothing to me, which is...
That's interesting.
It is. To this day, I thought sure I was going to feel like probably...
oh, yeah, I bet you were, too.
Did you say... I'm sure it was because of the sergeant major
mm-hmm.
that he interceded. Did any incidents over the papers earlier and some other stuff, right up to the end when... When we came back from the fire base, and we only had a couple of months left,
mm-hmm.
we were in a quantry on stand down,
mm-hmm.
and we had a ground attack, and I was having a barbecue at the time
mm-hmm.
with a couple of friends,
right.
And we just kept on with our barbecue, just didn't bother going to the bunker or anything, and. The next day, that was the final when he finally decided to go after me.
Okay.
And he said immediately that I was transferred back to our line company. He transferred me back to our line company. Then he assigned a line company mail clerk as a battalion mail clerk.
Uh huh.
And that lasted 48 hours. Because he forgot to check some regulations. And when he found out the company mail clerk did not pick up the battalion's mail,
crap.
He wanted me to go pick up the mail, and I refused to. I said, I'm incompetent. I can't do it. I'm too incompetent.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up transferring me back and sending the mail back. But they went like 3 or 4 days with no mail for the whole battalion.
Until he realized that he had to have you.
Yeah.
I mean, this sounds like this is a war of nerves between you guys for many months. I mean, you know, more than half a year, it sounds like.
Yeah, pretty much. he rotated before me.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he rotated back, actually before then, they had to give a big ceremony when he was located because they could bring in the commander.
Right, because of his rank.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It's so many years ago, some of the stuff I have to admit is a little foggy.
Well, it's pretty clear to me that this was an ongoing, you know, struggle. But when you were, can you tell me just a little bit about being up at the line company for that two-day period or whatever? What happened to you? What did you observe? Where were you sent? Any idea?
Oh, I was on the same base. It was just over to some other hooches.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
But I had a much easier job.
Which was?
The company mail clerk. You just
You
pretty much got the mail in the morning, a little paperwork to do. You pretty much just sat around all day. There's not a lot of stuff to do.
Whereas, as the battalion clerk, you had all these different responsibilities.
Yeah, yeah.
You mentioned yesterday very briefly that if any of those mail clerks themselves were were killed, you had to take over their duties. Did that ever happen?
No.
Or was I maybe I misunderstood you?
So the what I had to do on a lot of the levels was with when people were killed in the company units.
Yeah.
I would have to assist the company mail clerk to make sure that all the valuables are properly packed.
What was the protocol for that? I mean, did you have to sign a bunch of papers and inventory everything and all that?
Yeah, exactly. That was all the personal belongings that had to be accounted for.
Okay.
And documented and properly packed, and whoever they had listed as their next of kin, the stuff had to have been sent to.
Okay.
And the commanding officer, the company commanding officer, was supposed to, you know, write a letter of condolences and make sure that was sent out.
And so you had to handle those letters, but
yeah, to make sure it was done. That you know, the company clerks would just say, "Oh yeah, you know, I'll do that tomorrow. I'll get around to it."
Mm-hmm. Did you? How did you process that duty? I mean, I would think that would be a very, you know, something I would attach a lot of personal importance to, making sure that actually did get done. But how did you feel about having to do those jobs? I mean, that would have been hard, to say the least.
I mean, big supporter. I was so cold and just so cold and angry and. I was almost like a robot. It just, these things had to be done. I think part of it was, as long as I could take all my frustrations out on the colonel, I was happy. Mm-hmm. As long as I had him for a whipping post, I think I was all right. Yeah. I don't know if he may have been smarter than I thought and figured that out.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows?
And so one way of coping with it would be to try to kind of disconnect from what it actually meant. And another way would be to kind of, you know, be a screw up or be a pain in the ass to the higher ups and make them know that life wasn't easy. All those things together.
Yeah. If you put that all together, I just felt like, you know, it was all worthwhile as long as I was pissing off the battalion commander or somebody, some high-ranking officer.
So your anti-authority stuff was just in full bloom.
Yeah, I believe that was pretty much in my record, to say that I was antisocial.
I'll bet.
The view of it.
Well, Janice, let me ask you about the enemy. And maybe the enemy was people who sent you there, I'm not sure. But in terms of the Vietnamese, you mentioned in the forms that I asked you to fill out before we did the interview that you were very clear on the difference between the VC and the NVA, and especially when you were involved in the Lam Son 719 operation. I mean, you were up in what was essentially NVA country. Can you offer any observations about the enemy and what you thought about who the United States was actually in conflict with?
It was all the same, you know, enemy, but it was just a different method of fighting.
Mm-hmm.
The Viet Cong, the guerrillas, which were pretty much predominantly South Vietnamese,
yeah,
and were, you know, farmers or local people that just they pretty much all they wanted was for the American army to leave, like the same reason that they wanted the French colonists to leave, and they just wanted to be left alone. And it, you know, their tactics were occasional sniper fire and, you know, the landmines,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, RPGs. It was kind of fighting a different, from a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But in Quantry Promise and going up north,
right,
when actually fighting what I call a hardcore North Vietnamese army, it was much different. I mean, just in Nemes alone, we were massively out Nemes. At least, in the end, when he took out our units and sent them home,
mm-hmm.
and we were just using the South Vietnamese, the Ivan unit.
Yeah, right.
We're talking about a hardcore experienced army that had been fighting for what they perceived as their freedom from colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
This is the same army that defeated France and chased them out.
Yes, absolutely.
And they, they had been organized, meeting, fighting machine, from the 50s. So well trained and with a very defined mission. And, massive Nemes. It was so dug in up north in the rock pile, and their supply lines along the Ho Chi Minh Trail were just so well dug in and so fortified.
Mm-hmm.
You just well-oiled, high, well-trained fighting machine. And we, for the most part, were a bunch of kids out of high school who didn't give a shit. Put it bluntly.
Mm-hmm. Even with our high-tech stuff and our command of the air.
Yeah, even with our high-tech and our high... We were there for the average soldier for 365 days, and that was it. And we were fighting against an army that had been fighting for their freedom since the early 50s.
Mm-hmm. One thing that you mentioned in the paperwork that you filled out that caught my eye was just a brief mention that you made about seeing some Russian information about Russian tanks. I think you said intelligence pictures. Do you remember that? What did you see?
When in the waning days of Lam Soon 719,
mm-hmm.
After Mary Ann got over Van, which was a fire base not too far from where I was.
Mary Ann. Mm-hmm.
Yes. The whole division just went to that base like it was nothing, just totally wiped it out.
Right.
The message was, and he had completely defeated the South Vietnamese army, pushing them out of Laos, had them on the run.
Yes,
We were getting rocketed every night, ground attacks every night, and it was just a question. We knew that we basically were in this valley, and all these chain of fire bases were completely surrounded, completely. Anytime they wanted to, they could have wiped out this whole chain of fire bases.
Mm-hmm.
But the message was, hey, look, we can do it. We don't want to kill no more Americans. Just leave. And this is what the Paris peace talks are going on.
Right.
And this was kind of, we were nothing but puppets. We were a message, to Kissinger. Checkmate. You're going to surrender, or do you want us to run through and kill the rest of the Americans out of here? Then the average anybody that was in Vietnam at the time that was really aware of what was going on, with the Paris Peace Talks,
mm-hmm.
and the whole situation. But in a way, I'm kind of... We were waiting and waiting for orders to leave the fire bases. The mission pretty much was over. It was a disaster.
Lam Son 719, or more broadly, the war.
Lam Soon 719.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they went in and they destroyed a lot of stuff, but they got pushed back. And they were not going to bring up any units. What our commanders wanted was for them to bring up what was left of the Miracal Division.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Miracal Division in the 1st Cav was still in the middle and south.
Yes.
If we had brought them up to back the Ivan units and gone into Laos, the operation would have been a complete success. I think we could have fought back the NVA,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't do that. Instead, they just let the Ivan units get overwhelmed, Now, this is all just my personal opinion.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. That, and
this is interesting.
Mm-hmm. We, the weakest, more or less, said, well, this didn't work, tough shit. We're not going to sacrifice any more American lives. As far as combat units, but all the support units that I was in, we were just left sitting ducks in this ploy.
Right, with the Arvin pretty much crushed and on the run.
Yeah.
The fire support base personnel up on the border area were just sitting ducks.
Yeah, and every day, you know, I was coming back, and I had all these orders from division and our battalion headquarters. Mm-hmm. And it was, well, we've got nothing on the radio. What are we doing? When are we pulling out? And I had no direct orders. But I was a direct link because I was down there every day. I would get into screaming matches with Colonel Ellis. Mm-hmm. And people would hear it. I mean, I would be calling him and saying, well, it would be down at division, to colonels down there, saying, I got to go back. When the hell are we pulling out? And he was saying, well, we need orders from Saigon. It's going to... they were just totally out of control. And at some point, we just... I think there were rumors going around that we had orders to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And one morning, people just started... on the fire base I was on, they just started bringing in the deuces and the five tons and said, we're going back. We're going south. And I don't think there was actually any order get given from Saigon. So what happened when we got back, we went back to Quang Tri Province. We didn't actually go back to Camp Eagle. We went to Quang Tri. No, we went back to Phu Bai. We didn't go back on Camp Eagle, but in Phu Bai, we had an area that we were put for stand down.
Okay.
All the Ho Battalion.
Somewhere near Phu Bai?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere along from that point on, I was still going back and forth. I was no longer with a forward command post. I was with our battalion headquarters. And I was still going down at Da Nang and Phu Bai, which is closed for the meal.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere along this time, I think it was stuff from intelligence or something that was going to division.
Okay.
And I saw they had all these pictures
mm-hmm.
of from one of our warrant officers, our W4 something, I forgot, whatever you call it. It was our battalion, you know, intelligence.
Yes, yes.
Had taken all these pictures from the air.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see, right after we left all these fire bases, we left all kinds of shit up there.
Equipment.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You know, heavy equipment, artillery equipment and stuff. And we just saw, they had all these pictures of them just plowing this road from Laos. They actually created a road with all the bulldozers.
Uh-huh.
And they saw all these tanks coming in. They were these brand new, it looked like they were brand new.
Uh-huh.
They all had the Russian symbols on them.
Okay.
And that, and I was like, wow. If we had stayed up there, that's how much they had built up, you know, coming across the Laotian border. That we never could have stopped any kind of attack like that.
So just to clarify, the thought was that some of the heavy equipment, or a lot, all of it that had been left, that had been abandoned in the withdrawal, had fallen to NVA, and they were using it for road construction and making the way for the tanks.
Yeah. They had come in, literally, taking all that equipment and were building up. And if you follow... after that, it was not. I left July of 71.
Right.
And I'm not sure how long I was home, 5 or 6 months, before all of the abandoning all of Quang Tri Province,
mm-hmm.
which is, falling all the way back to Da Nang and about the other main base. But they gave up all of military one, just retreated all the way back. Not too long after I left. And that was all the equipment, and eventually became all the staging areas, for them to eventually come all the way down to Saigon.
Yeah, for the eventual spring offensive.
Yeah, when you saw that when he came in with all those tanks, mm-hmm. they literally had all that equipment from Russia in 71. At that Battle of Lamphun.
And when you saw those photos and you kind of put together what it was you were seeing, did that take you to a whole new level of, kind of despair about what the United States was doing, or were you already kind of pretty much on the basement floor already?
No, that really was just another unbelievable. The concept of tanks is World War II stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The concept at that time of it's something that totally I just could not have a vision when I was on that firebase. If we got attacked, I just could not have pictured having a big ground attack and actually seeing tanks coming at us, Russian tanks.
Yeah,
it was beyond my imagination that that
was going to be introduced.
Yeah, we were winding down and our organization program.
Yes,
uh-huh. And we were kind of pulling back.
Mm-hmm.
Where the hell was our Army intelligence? That they, it carries over to me with some. I have some very hard feelings about Henry Kissinger. And what was going on at the peace talks, and
how much did you know about it?
Why?
When it was going on.
The early days. The first 6 months, we were arguing over if they were going to use a round table or a square table.
Yes, that's right.
And I thought that was important.
Mm-hmm.
And I understood. I know from the beginning where their priorities were at.
Some people have gone so far as to say that Dr. Kissinger is actually viewed by history as a basically a war criminal. Does that sound right to you?
I don't know if it was a war criminal, but I think he was a buffoon and a bubbler.
Really?
And a bubbler. Yeah.
Do you still think that?
Yeah. That he...
Wow.
War criminal is a very strong term.
Yes, it is.
If he should be cried as a war criminal, then so should I.
Because?
I participated in the war.
Okay.
I followed orders like any other good Nazi. Mm-hmm. If you want to... mm-hmm. You get into the Nuremberg trials, it gets really heavy and complicated.
Yes, it is very complicated.
Well,
at
what level? Do you just trial the generals? Are the generals just war criminals? All officers? Where do you draw the line?
Mm-hmm.
And it is, it's very, but I think Kissinger as a diplomat was a complete buffoon.
Do you think he was out of his league when dealing with the Vietnamese and the Chinese?
Yeah, I think they ate him up and spit him out.
Wow, he would spin if he knew anyone in America thought that about him. Because, he's worked very hard to brush up his image over all these years.
Yeah, well, too bad.
I thought that probably would have zero effect.
I still cringe. Every time I see him on any news program, would he look at him as a, respected diplomat or whatever you want to call him?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, elder statesman.
Elder statesman. Mm-hmm. Didn't he surrender? Pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
That's totally what I call it. I call the Paris Peace Corps the surrender. He did everything but take his sword off and put it on the table.
And what about the position of the South Vietnamese government in those negotiations? Of course, as you know, Kissinger talked directly with Hanoi and sort of left South Vietnam out. Was that a betrayal of them as well?
Oh, yeah. It was a total betrayal of the South Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that I believed in is there was a lot of corruption in the South Vietnamese government.
Mm-hmm.
And that was their own fault, and that's what killed them. But the good percentage, and I went to, I was invited to a dinner about 6 months ago in Tampa. Mm-hmm. There's a real big population, a Vietnamese population down here.
Mm-hmm.
And they were having a dinner to honor, the honor of the history of South Vietnam and the honor of the South Vietnamese, the Republic of South Vietnam flag. And I was invited to this dinner. One of the most moving things, I think, right up there, one of the most moving things in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And there were all these, a lot of young people. And actually, not only young people, a lot of old people that had served in the South Vietnamese Army.
Right.
And the they were trying to keep the history of their country, and what they considered their country was the Republic of Vietnam, alive.
Mm-hmm.
And hope someday that they could win their freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, that, you know, that was what I saw with some of the people in South Vietnam. I think, unfortunately, they were, I don't know if they were a minority, or maybe they were even. There was just too much corruption in their government. Too much infiltration from people that put unifying the country as a higher priority. I think that really what ended it all.
Did you have much interaction at all over the time you were there with Vietnamese civilians, let's say, who were not involved in the black market, who were not officials, but just civilians that you would see along the way? Did you have much interaction at all?
Only with some of the young women, the hooch maids, as mm-hmm. we call them,
mm-hmm.
that used to clean our hooches.
Mm-hmm.
There was one that really, I think at least she had the hearts for me.
Really?
Yeah, she had something mm-hmm. that I just didn't want to go there.
Mm-hmm.
We talked a lot, and she told me, I don't know, a couple of weeks before I had any official news that we were going to be going up north,
mm-hmm.
she told me that she heard from people that there was a big operation and we all were going to be going up north.
And when it actually came to pass, what went through your mind?
That if she knows, did the NVA know? I mean, we're calling this a secret operation. It was no secret operation. They were waiting for us.
I mean, I wouldn't know whether to laugh or cry, to be honest with you. I mean, that's really actually a frightening moment. It must have been frightening.
Oh, it was, but it just totally, you know, convinced that there was always the suspicion of, you know, the Vietnamese that were working on the base.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Who amongst them was, you know, were working for Viet Cong?
Right.
And we knew some of them were. There was just no way of knowing who was who.
You didn't know which ones to...
Yeah, so who to trust, who right. not to trust.
Right.
I mean, I trusted this woman. I mean, I just had a strong sense that she cares for me.
An intuitive sense.
Yeah.
On some human level.
Yeah.
We're talking about.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, you know, strictly on a personal level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, she... I mean, she just saw me... as somebody that really wasn't an enemy or really fighting the war. I was somebody that was either writing journals or reading poetry. I even used to read some poetry to her every now and then.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And it was a different...
Have you given her much thought over the years?
Yeah. mm-hmm. Yeah. Her and, you know, what people... I mean, it's... the whole carryover on and this kind of goes back to what we were talking about, Kissinger and him.
Mm-hmm.
The way he ended it with, okay, just give us time to get all our troops out before you invade Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
It was total betrayal. And the people, you know, the people that got hurt the most were the people the people that, the South Vietnamese people that did believe in us, that did want a democracy, those were the people that we left, that we left behind, and ended up either murdered or, you know, tortured or whatever. I mean, it was a brutal, vicious, the communist regime that moved in and took over, let's say it today. I mean, these people now are just working and working for pennies, a bit more or less than slave labor. You know,
right.
But you can buy some of the products that came out at Walmart now.
You sure can.
Did I say that story about when I was working at Ames a few years ago?
At where?
Ames Department Store.
No.
When I was up in southern New Hampshire, five years ago, I was in the middle of my transitioning, and it was really hard for me to get a part-time job because most places don't hire transsexuals.
Right.
And there was a chain of department stores in New England called Ames that they're out of business now.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like Kmart and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And they hired me putting out stock. I work part-time, like 3 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And you come in the morning, you have all the cartload of stuff that, some of the stuff you hung up, some you went on shelves. And I came in one day, it was the first time I ever saw it. It was a box, I don't know what it was in it, some clothing. And it had a big thing on it, you know, imported from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I just took the box, and this cute little feminine woman
mm-hmm.
took the box and picked it and threw it across the room and said I quit and left. And there were about three or four people in the stock room,
mm-hmm.
and they all were just looking at me. They couldn't believe it.
And they had no idea.
Oh, they were totally cool. Uh-huh. Oh, what the hell? Yeah, I mean, they all were. I mean, you know, what hit her? And I just walked out and I went home. And this woman's supervisor called me. What happened? Did somebody say something to you? She thought maybe somebody had said something to me with the transgender issue.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted to know, you know, if anybody was harassing me.
That's actually very interesting in its own terms. But.
Yeah, it, you know, because she was the one that rooted for them to hire me to give me the chance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was a big issue. Believe me, they wouldn't let me use the bathrooms.
Really?
They wouldn't hire me unless I agreed. They had one handicap parcel. That as long as I agreed to stay out of both the men's room and the women's room.
And like this all had to be negotiated before they would agree to hire you.
Yeah, this is some part-time minimum wage job.
Okay. Wow.
And
this stressed them out in a big way.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, and the job had very little contact with the customers.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out great though, because I ended up I fixed up their whole female underwear section.
There you go.
And the place was a mess. I mean, it was. People ripped things open.
Uh-huh.
I had all the bras in the right order. Mm-hmm. I had everything. And they ended up keeping me in that area.
Uh-huh.
And I had customers come up to women asking me questions about bra sizes and stuff.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah. They knew who to ask.
You know, for transgender women, it was wild. This is acceptance.
That's right. You take it where you can find it, I'm sure.
But uh-huh. I explained to the woman, I wasn't even sure she knew that I was a Vietnam veteran. It was on my application somewhere. But when I just told her that I just couldn't deal with that. That I'm not hanging up stuff from Vietnam. And I told her, I wasn't sure if she knew or not, that I have just 100% post-traumatic stress disorder from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I know, it's been a lot of years ago and stuff. I just said, the idea of all these years for me to be, you know, handling products from Vietnam, I just said I had 10 children.
And did she listen to you?
Yeah, she was kind of, you know, I think in a way fascinated.
Mm.
You are complex, aren't you? But
right, and it's not all about gender.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, which actually it is part of why it's really great that you told that story.
Okay, it was But I ended up staying there, and she just she had to her and the other managers.
Mm-hmm.
What they would do is the trucks come in at night, or in, you know, in the afternoon or at night, and the night manager just put together these little trucks that you pull to the store.
Mm-hmm.
All these different boxes. So each person that came in the morning would have a load of stuff that they had to, you know, put out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she just made sure that nothing with a Vietnam label was put on my truck ever again.
And how long did you then? I mean, clearly she invited you back, and how long did you stay there after this?
Oh, I went there for close to 2 years. I was working there when I moved down here. That's the only reason I quit.
Mm-hmm.
I went through my whole transition there. It was really neat when I came back from my surgery and stuff. And I just it was just amazing how even the employees there, how they treated me from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And how they got to know me, especially, you know, after my surgery, the issue was the bathroom issue went away.
Yeah, remarkable.
And it was even I think when the last Christmas I was there, I was looking at these little stained glass angels,
mm-hmm.
little tiny things,
mm-hmm.
and I was going to buy one, but it was too expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the employees was there, saw me looking at it, and she ended up buying it for me, gave it to me for a Christmas gift.
Really?
Yeah, and she said she admitted that she was the woman that said she would. She told the manager that she would quit if they hired me, if she ever saw me in a woman's room.
Turned out, she decided that you weren't so bad after all. Huh?
Yeah, I was actually human.
Mm-hmm. So. Janice, let's stop there.